Ready for a career in behavioral health? Earn your online degree at Herzing University. Choose from health and human services, psychology, or social work programs. Gain the skills to work, coordinate, and manage nonprofits. Secure a bachelor's in psychology to study mental health or advance your social work career through our online Masters of Social Work. Let us help you become a social change agent. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Text HEALTH to 85109. That's HEALTH to 85109. Or visit herzing.edu.
For me, it's done more than just the ability to read clocks and decipher time and what it's trying to teach me, but it's done a lot to my sense of self and my own self-worth as well. I've got a lot more confidence and I feel a lot more calmer going into the things that I have anxiety built around.
Hello and welcome to the Women and ADHD podcast. I'm your host, Katie Weber. I was diagnosed with ADHD at the age of 45, and it completely turned my world upside down. I've been looking back at so much of my life, school, jobs, my relationships, all of it with this new lens, and it has been nothing short of overwhelming. I quickly discovered I was not the only woman to have this experience, and now I interview other women who, like me, discovered in adulthood they have ADHD and are finally feeling like they understand who they are and how to best lean into their strengths, both professionally and personally. The following is a review on the Apple Podcasts platform from Tuttle 2007. It's entitled Life-Changing, Honest, and Real. The validity that I feel when listening to these podcasts is unreal. There are things I've never shared with anyone because I felt too crazy or lazy. Yet to hear so many women, obviously intelligent, successful, and professional women, voice the same thoughts and concerns and habits, I can't express the void it fills. I finally found people who think similarly and no longer feel broken. Thank you for all that you do, and please, and this is in all caps, keep it up. And then Tuttle goes on to give 16 gold stars. So thank you, Tuttle. I am beyond thrilled that you found this podcast and that it's meant so much to you. And I am so appreciative that you took the time to review the podcast because it means other women like you are going to be able to find these interviews too. Okay, this is episode 51, in which I interview Tessa McKay. Tessa paints contemporary realism and large-scale hyper-realism portraiture and is based in Perth, Australia. Despite being diagnosed with dyslexia and ADHD from an early age, she only recently started to embrace and work on the kind of quirks that are associated with ADHD in women. Tessa and I talk all about introversion and the emotional intensity of the creative process as a neurodivergent artist, as well as the inevitable imposter syndrome that comes along. We also talk about neuroplasticity training and Tessa's lifelong journey to learn to read analog clocks. I highly recommend you visit Tessa's website, which is tessamckay.com, and that's also in my show notes, because she is absurdly talented, like jaw-droppingly talented. Her paintings will blow you away. Here we go. Enjoy. So now you were diagnosed at a younger age, right?
Yeah, yes.
Yeah, so tell me about growing up with an ADHD diagnosis.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because my brother was diagnosed as ADHD later and is like sort of throughout high school, and he like showed sort of classic symptoms, I know, signs. And so obviously my parents, like classic sort of story, but I showed like tendencies to have some sort of neurodivergence at an earlier, like really early age. But then I was, the teacher sort of told my parents, and then, I was diagnosed as having dyslexic tendencies. So it's interesting because I remember I think it was a year four or year three or something, I was in my class and we're learning how to write letters, and the teacher was telling us how to write the letter E like an elephant, and she wrote it on the board, and I just remember this thing of just looking at the board and then looking at my paper and looking at the person, the kid next to me, who had his whole A4 sheet with little letters E all over it. And I looked at mine and I just like thought, I can't keep up with this kid. I've only got two E's. And there I drew elephants in the shape of E's. So they had like every E had like a little tusk and horns, like, and yeah, like it looked like a little elephant like that. I had like maybe three elephants, and I thought, I can't keep up. I don't know how I'm going to possibly fill the page full of elephants.
Took the teacher very literally.
Yeah,
that's fascinating to me. My son is, he's nine, he's in the fourth grade, and I had never heard of dyspraxia until recently because his teacher was really getting on him about his handwriting, and it's terrible, especially when he's stressed out and has anxiety. I can see it, you know, it manifests in his handwriting.
Mm.
And I was noticing that like the more she told him to concentrate on his handwriting, like the harder it was for him to actually write anything, like to articulate his thoughts, you know.
Yay.
Like I could just see it, his brain working so hard, and I felt for him. And I remember asking his teacher to be like, look, we need to lay off on this handwriting thing, because it's really not that important. Mm-mm. Like I think it's more important for him to be able to kind of connect with his thoughts and his ability to communicate. But then when I went back into my old report cards, I had no idea that I was also like had had no memory of this, but apparently my teachers had all complained about my terrible handwriting.
Oh, wow.
I know. I had no memory of it until I had gone back to look at my old report cards.
That's incredible.
And I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So how did you get through that process of relaxing and writing, or just don't even think
about
it?
I have no memory of my childhood, which I think is actually not uncommon with women with ADHD that have like very little memory. And I don't know if it's just the trauma.
Big chunks of blank periods.
Right. Yeah. So I don't know if it's really just like, feeling like you're kind of going through the motions a lot of the time as a kid. I don't have very, very lucid memories of any of my childhood, but I do remember my mom telling me that I was originally left-handed and my kindergarten teacher forced me to become right-handed.
No. Wow.
And so I was like, not only did you force me to become right-handed, but then you complained about my terrible handwriting. I'm like,
what a bitch.
Right? Seriously. But I was never diagnosed with anything. And so I'm curious, when I talk to women who were diagnosed with either dyslexia or dysgraphia or some of the other learning disabilities, they often say that like they felt a little more, I don't know what the word is, like cared for, or, you know, that there was some kind of ways in which there were modifications made in the classroom for them. So, so they didn't necessarily have that experience of like, something's wrong and nobody's noticing.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious, did you feel like you were getting extra help when you needed it?
Or do you
feel like they were just way off in that diagnosis?
I think you just have to look at the times, really. And I think I was really lucky with being sort of, identified with having learning disabilities or, you know, difficulties, and at a young age. So then that just sort of became a part of my identity, and knowing that about myself made me feel a little like more comfortable, obviously, but at the same time, the teachers had no idea how to really handle it, I think, or they were still, I got the sense that I was still a bit of a guinea pig for trying to figure out how to teach me basic English and maths and clocks, reading clocks. I only learned how to read clocks maybe a couple of months ago. And I remember the teacher, multiple teachers tried teaching me how to read analog clocks, and so did the principal, and they just eventually gave up because it was just too difficult. So I think, I think, like you're saying, you don't really remember big chunks of your childhood, but I certainly remember the periods in which I felt really sort of swamped and overwhelmed, and the inability to respond to things, or just feeling that sort of disconnect from the group a lot. And it's really interesting, those sorts of things. But I'm just trying to think of another scenario. Definitely learning language. And I stopped when I got to high school. I was really lucky. I had a good group of friends. And then sort of towards the end of high school, I dropped out of maths and English just because I was just falling behind. It was the curriculum was designed to be for students who would achieve it at a certain pace, and I could just never catch up with them. So I'll constantly fall short of like 10 or 20% under like average on most of my subjects. And no matter how hard I tried, I just felt it. Never really, if like my effort was never commensurate to the scores I was trying to get. So yeah, that was, mm-hmm. that was quite disheartening. And so I got to the point where, and I have been drawing as early as I can remember. So I guess, you know, drawing, I mean, all my test papers were covered in animals. It's such a daydreamer. And it's interesting, like I can't quite discern between what's dyslexic and what's ADHD. And maybe you could help provide some insight into that as well. So I'm just trying to unpack everything. But I was such a daydreamer. And remember coming home to school, home from school once and telling mum I had a great maths class, and then told her all about the birds that were outside and like what was happening outside. That was maths. So but yeah, just really, really struggling at school. But drawing and art became a place that I would just escape to every day. So that you know, I've got a lot to thank for my school experience because I was able to do that and had those experiences as well. So yeah, and had really good supportive teachers around me that knew I was a little different, needed some help. And I think that that helped a lot. Having sort of your peers and teachers that understand you, even if they can't really help you in the ways of you achieving higher marks in academia, that counts for a lot, because it just, otherwise you feel a bit more on the outside, I think. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so you, how old were you when you were diagnosed with ADHD?
Yeah, I was diagnosed with ADHD when I was, goodness, I think 18. Yeah, so.
Oh, okay.
All right. Teens.
And was your brother's experience with academia the same?
No, he.
Could you relate?
Yeah, he was good. He really enjoyed school and he got good marks. But he needed, he was on medication to help him focus because he was just the trouble kid at school. So yeah. And then I'm on medication to help with my writing. So, yeah. And that's been very helpful for me. So yeah.
And what was your parents' reaction when they found out?
Not surprised at all. I think they just want to see me, you know, every parent just wants to see their kid not struggle at something. So, and seeing my brother, how it's affected my brother and helped him and supported him, they were pretty assured that it will help me as well. Writing has just been really tricky. And I think with basic stuff like text messages and emails and getting back to people, there's just so much anxiety around that basic stuff for me that it's actually pulling me away from the work I need to be doing, which is, you know, painting and et cetera. So when you sort of start to see those, like you start to carve out your day and you go, geez, I spend like a good 3 hours trying to write basic emails to people. That should take me like half an hour or at most an hour. You do realize how much time you're pulling yourself away from the work you need to be doing. So I think that's when I started to ask for help and yeah, look at other options. And the Arrowsmith program is fantastic for that too. So yeah.
Yeah, and it's funny how much we beat ourselves up for not wanting to or not being good at some of the most like ridiculously mundane tasks, like responding to people in email or even just chores, you know, like I remember just feeling like so much weight was taken off when I was thinking about all of these terrible ways that I'm, you know, I'm such a terrible homemaker and I'm so messy and my whole family must be so disappointed in me. And then I just remember at some point,
self-loathing,
just being like, who likes to do dishes? Like, of course you don't like doing dishes. It's boring. Why would you like to do that? And I just remember just being like, oh, right. Like, that's absurd. Like, if, why would I want to be good at those things?
Yeah, you know,
like I'm putting all of my focus in the wrong places. And I think we have a tendency to like put value into things that we can't do because like, it's almost like it mystifies you. Like other people are good at these things.
Yeah.
And so, and I'm not. So you put like an you put like an inflated value on those things.
Yeah.
And really some of those things are
so
like
trivial.
Least interesting.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right? Exactly.
Well, like, I just remember, and I'm still like this, like, I'm just like, I have to, if I have to be somewhere on time, oh man, it's so hard. I remember I would get to the place like a day before or like the wrong day or something. And then I'll try and get there on the right day and I'll get there 2 days after. Like it just wouldn't. It was just so,
I know,
so tricky arriving at a place, certain place and time on the right time. Yeah, it's just, and you just feel, those basic things are really hard. And friends as well I really, if I'm with somebody, I'm with them as well. But it's, I have to remind myself to really reach out to my friends, and it's not, nothing, obviously nothing personal. You just get so focused on what is in your immediate world. So just hearing all that from your other ladies that you've interviewed as well is just really interesting. All those sorts of things that you relate to, little things. Yeah.
Right? I'm endlessly amazed at how these like seemingly random struggles from throughout my life, you know, all play into this one diagnosis, like this one neat little package in such an incredible way. We're like, oh, right. You know, even just the term hyperactivity is something that so many of us don't relate to in the beginning because you think of like a little boy who's being hyperactive and we're like, well, that isn't me. I was staring at the birds.
Yeah.
Right. But then when you start to kind of reinterpret hyperactivity and how it manifests itself in your thoughts and your brains and impulsivity and like rage,
you know,
right? And it's like, oh yeah, okay, fine. I check all of those boxes. All right. And now it's like, oh, I like really deeply relate to the hyperactivity element of ADHD now.
The fossa king, the intense fossa king.
Right?
Yeah.
Or just like the mood swings and
man.
All of that. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to not get so emotionally just like triggered by stuff too. So, but it's a double-edged sword for me because I'm an artist. So you inherently, the work that you do, you're just like you're inherently trying to like feel understood through your work as an artist. And then when you're working with people or clients or something and you know, a debate happens or an issue happens, it's just very hard to it's a double-edged sword because you obviously it's very, you care about the work, very hard to take things personally, but yeah, that hyperactivity or that emotional regulation.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I can't even imagine as an artist dealing, you know, I just finished putting together a course and now I'm trying to sell it. And that's the part I hate the most is the self-promotion, the selling, you know, because it's such an emotional roller coaster. From one minute, I'm like, I send out an email and I'm like, okay, you can buy this thing. And then it's crickets. And then I'm like, I've made a terrible mistake. Nobody wants this thing. This is the worst thing ever.
I need
to quit. And right. What have I done? I've made a fool out of myself. And then you know, one person buys it and I'm like, yes, this is amazing. Okay, now I have to do this and I have to do this and I'm going to make this. And, you know, and you go back on the track where you're just like, I'm going to do all of these
suddenly
things.
Your commitment
and
to
then
like this
that
high.
Falls.
Yeah.
Like it's exhausting. And I'm just, so, I mean, there's so much subjectivity when it comes to like selling and as an entrepreneur, right? And it's so like, that is the thing that drives me crazy because I can't work for other people. I've just admitted that part. I just can't. I've tried it many times and I can't stick with a job longer than 2 years. So that part is out of it. So I'm curious, like, you know, I've had that issue with it as an entrepreneur. I can't even imagine that emotional roller coaster of being somebody who is so incredibly objectively talented as an artist. I mean, you are incredibly talented, so you must get compliments, you know, on your work. But at the same time, I know as somebody with ADHD, what an emotional roller coaster it must be to then always sort of feel like,
yeah,
am I actually, you know, are people saying, you know, like, what is the subtext and all of that? So now when you reached out to me, you had talked about like your sort of reflections on just on your path as an artist and looking back at how ADHD has played into that.
Yeah.
So I'm curious.
It's fascinating.
What are some of your reflections?
Yeah. So going back to, you know, school and education, I left when I was just before year 12 and I remember going, okay, well, I'm going to study art and that's who I'm going to be, obviously. And then I went into, you know, university through disability and portfolio. And I thought, okay, well, they should have some support there for artists as well who struggle with you know, the written units. And I really struggled at uni. And again, it's just that whole theory and conceptual side that I really struggled at, because what I expected from university was technical, was learning the technicalities of painting and sculpture and fine arts. I didn't realize it was going to be so concept heavy, and I just associated that with so much writing, and also I found it really hard to do that deeper reflection of asking the questions beyond questions. And And so I found that, again, I took that on myself so personally, and I found like a bit of, I found I was questioning myself after first year. And although there's quite a high dropout rate, I just got so anxious. And so I left, and I thought, well, I'm just going to, approach art in the way that I am craving. And then eventually I'll come back to uni when I'm ready. Because it seems like I'm just too young to go to uni. So I did. I went out and I painted a series of portraits, and then I came back to uni the next year. I deferred for a year and then came back. And the same thing, I just really struggled. And so I thought, I sort of made a pact with myself, and I thought, well, look, I love the technicalities of painting. I love the skill involved. And I thought if I could just paint, if I could just focus on that and do that to the best of my ability, hopefully that will just speak louder than whatever conceptual underpinning I could come up with. So hopefully people can just sort of see it like that. And so I've just really, essentially, I just have focused on that for years, and I've gone down the path of hyperrealism, which is like, very technically based realism. And so I guess, yeah, what I've realized though is I've sort of painted myself into a corner in some ways, because I've not, the art world is inherently fickle, and it, you need to be able to discuss your works and have, yeah, you need to be able to have a conversation about the work and your intent, and that sort of aspect of being an artist, it scares the crap out of me. And I'm really not good at it. So I've avoided that by one, going down the technical path, but then also just not practicing that. So now I'm going back to the books, and now I'm trying to expose myself to, theory and philosophy, and discovering why it is, what is it about painting that I love, and why do I paint, and all those questions, stuff that I've never focused on. And it's hard. It's really, really difficult. But it's exciting as well. It's sort of showing me sides of myself that I'd never thought I would find challenging and rewarding. And it's really interesting. So sort of like a long answer to your question.
Yeah, no, it was interesting when you were talking. You were reminding me of Naomi Osaka and the kind of issue that she's going through right now with the tennis player who is refusing to talk to the media because she was protecting her mental health. And so she was getting fined for not talking to the media.
No.
And then there's been this bad. And so then she had to drop out of the French Open. I think it was the French Open.
Goodness.
Because she doesn't want to speak to the media afterwards because she finds it too stressful. And so now at least the fact that she's taken the stand, you know, Nike and some other companies are like backing her. And now there seems to be this backlash against this forced, you know, the fact that athletes are forced to do these promotional tours and talk to the media and do these things that they absolutely hate doing. And they obviously feel a lot of anxiety and stress around it. And I'm like, and I really relate to that deeply because I'm like, you're an athlete. Why this, you know, it's that same idea of like, you don't have to be good at everything.
And then
if these other things are bringing you stress, don't do them.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like a threat. I think, it's actually a physical, it's like a threat on your body completely. Because I would say to my lectures, which is no art lecture would ever want to hear this. I'd say, oh, the art speaks for itself. And you do not say that at art school. that's a huge no-no. But I genuinely believe that. But it is, you do have to show up in ways that are so challenging.
I think communicating ourselves in a way that, in a way in which we fundamentally feel understood can be so difficult for people with ADHD. I'm just listening to Sari Solden's book on women with ADHD. And she was talking about the same thing, which was like, and this book was written ages ago. This is one of the very first book on women with ADHD. And she was talking about, you know, how we tend to kind of clam up and be very quiet and kind of withdraw in social situations because you often feel like you're betrayed by what's coming out of your mouth because sometimes you just can't even communicate your thoughts very well and you never know what's going to come out.
Yeah, that's
she was
such a
talking
good point.
About like, yeah, right? Totally. And she was like talking about like avoiding social situations because you can't predict what mood you'll be in when you enter a room and you can't, right? And it's like, so for your own safety, you're just like, I'm not going to put anyone in that position because I can't guarantee A, what's going to come out of my mouth or like B, if I'm going to be happy or sad. Like there's so much about the way that we communicate that feels like a betrayal to ourselves sometimes.
That's so
true. Often we just end up like clamming up and then somebody's like, how are you? And then we just say, I'm good, thank you. And then, you know, and then we get labeled the quiet one, even though we are anything but quiet when given, you know, the right combination.
Totally. There's so many situations I would go home and I'd just be processing what's just happened and I'd be thinking, reliving the experience. And when I'm deep in a painting, often I won't see people, you know, just my husband, we just see each other and he's a writer director. So he's the same sort of like introvert as well. He spends like weeks in his room and he just sees his wife and his cat. That's about it. And so, but then when we go into social situations, because we've been so, in our quiet place for so long, you do have to really psych yourself up. But it's even harder because of, you know, your dispositions as well in social situations. So, which is great chatting with you because it's good for me to practice talking. I think that's, it genuinely is. Yeah. I love it, which is great.
Well, I know. And I think that my husband is a bona fide introvert. He always says, you know, he's always been one. And, you know, I used to ask him a lot, like, what do you love about me? What, you know, I know why I chose you, but I could never figure out why he chose me. And he would always say things, ridiculous things like, well, when I'm with you, I feel like I'm by myself. And I'm like, well, that kind of sucks. But as an introvert, that's like the greatest compliment, yeah, right? Yeah. Because he's like, I don't feel any, you know, he was like, I knew the moment I met you, I felt no anxiety. I felt no awkwardness. Like I just felt at peace. Yeah. And that was like the best compliment an introvert could give. But for me, I was sort of like, okay, I guess that's a compliment, right? Because I can never decide if I'm an introvert or not, because like I love, you know, one-on-one conversations. And I think something that I think a lot of us, I don't know if it's women with ADHD or just ADHD, but like I feel a constant desire to connect with people. Mm. So I can get very lonely feeling if I'm just like at home doing my own thing. Like I always feel like I'm missing out. You know, that meme of like, I don't want to go to the party, but I really want to be invited to the party.
Yeah.
Right. And so there's that sense of like always looking and searching. And I think that that's something that we have. A lot of us have that need, you know, I know in ADHD 2.0, and I think even in the Driven to Distraction book, like they talk about connection and vitamin C and how that is one of the biggest ways that we can actually treat our ADHD is to talk to other people with ADHD and feel that connection and feel like we're not alone. And there are other people with these weird quirks who, you know, have trouble brushing their teeth and like random things that you're like, oh, thank God, I'm not the only one. Right. Right.
Yeah.
And how like that feeds us in a way that is not necessarily typical of an introvert, you know, like I think we crave a sense of connection that never quite feels right a lot of the time in most social situations.
Yeah.
And then you're like, oh, I just want to go home.
Yeah. It's time. Let's go. Yeah. No, that's so true. It's, you don't even really need to say to somebody I'm ADHD or something. You just feel it. I feel like people with any sort of neurodivergence is like you just sort of you feel it in the room and there's that connection. It's really, really fascinating. And then when eventually it does come out that they're dyslexic or whatever, it's just sparks just sort of happen. It's just you kind of go, oh, okay, there we go. My right. friend, he was diagnosed late. Later in life, and he's like, I can't believe this is my whole life just sort of explained and why I am the way I am. And it's so fascinating. I think COVID as well, how you were saying before, how a lot of women are being diagnosed now later in life because of the lockdowns, and they're seeing it in their kids and reflected through themselves. It's just, that's very fascinating. It's like one of the silver lines.
Yeah, right. Mm. Well, and I think now it'll be interesting as everything really sort of goes back to quote unquote normal, or hopefully not back to normal, but you know, as we start to like, I don't want to return to what things were, but I think at the same time, like as we start opening up and getting back into a more routine, it'll be interesting to see like, was a lot of this actually ADHD, or was it sort of just the trauma of the pandemic and everything happening? Like, you know, so, but then again, I think something that is very endemic to ADHD is constantly wondering if you actually have ADHD, which then I'm like, I feel like that's usually a sign you have it. If you're constantly wondering, is this actually it? And you can't stop thinking about it and you can't stop doubting. And you're like, I don't know. Like there's often times where I'm like, I don't know, maybe I'm just a feminist living in a misogynist world. And like we had Trump for the last 4 years, like this, I have PTSD from living in this country. Like maybe that's all this is. Right. And so
much noise.
So, yeah. Right. But then I go back to this sense of like, no, the fact that I'm like manically obsessing over whether I have ADHD is pretty much guaranteed that I actually have it. Right. But like you said, like finding other neurodivergent people there is that sense of like home, you know, and feeling like so accepted, because there really is like the weirder, the better.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, we'll take it, whatever. Yeah. You're in a safe place.
Suddenly the conversation just branches out to just anything and everything, really. Yeah. And then it's been 3 days.
And then, like, the humor starts getting weird. Yeah, I know.
Exactly. People start dropping Simpson quotes. It's, yeah.
Okay, so tell me more about the Aerosmith program, because you had mentioned it in one of our correspondence when you said you were working on strengthening your neurological pathways. So yeah. I don't know anything about this program, so tell me about it.
Yeah, it's quite a mouthful.
And how did you find it?
Yeah, so, well, oh gosh, it's like another silver lining of COVID, because my mum had been aware of this program, Barbara Arrowsmith created it. And her argument is that the brain, and this is, you know, back when people thought brains were fixed, I guess we were just born with brains that couldn't change. But her argument was there was neuroplasticity. So, you know, obviously we know that now, but that's the whole, I sort of the bedrock of why Arrowsmith is what Arrowsmith is to help connect neuropathways that had, you know, people had struck that people, there is a disconnect there in people. And so my mum was aware of this program when I was little, and, you know, even sort of pitched it to me to go over to Canada and do the course, but it was just the wrong time and I just thought no. But since COVID they've started doing an online courses for people, which has been great. And, you know, I do an hour 4 days a week, and honestly, it's just it's been one of the best things, because one, I can read clocks, woohoo, and then I've just felt like I've been able to progress in things that I've never been able to progress in before. And one of those things is writing. I can write emails a little better. I can read books without in a noisy environment without, and remember what I've read, which is nuts. And wow. Yeah, it's all those real simple little things that you just know that you need a very particular environment to do, but now it's a lot more easier to do those basic things. And it's fascinating. So everyone starts off, all the students start off with clocks, and they start off with two-hand clocks, and then eventually you do a series of exercises within the two-hand clocks, like equal length hands. You read, you decipher which one's a minute hand or the hour hand, and then you read the clock and try and get your time down as well. So it's about accuracy and speed, and then eventually they'll add another hand, so you'll have three hands, and then you'll have four hands, and then it goes all the way up to 10-handed clocks. So I'm at, I think, four hands now. So it's the way it's designed is that everyone learns at their own pace, and they're, it's sort of tailored so that you feel like you're achieving something every day. So you get that sense of achievement, and every day is, you do have to apply yourself and work at it every day, but you feel like you get something back from the effort that you put in, which is great. And then you sort of notice that over the course of a week or a month, you've gone from here to there, which is just so, I've never experienced that at school. And I just associate clocks and that sort of way of mode of thinking with school and education. Mm. So I think it's, for me, it's done more than just the ability to read clocks and decipher time and what it's trying to teach me, but it's done a lot to my sense of self and my own self-worth as well. Like, I've got a lot more confidence and a lot more, I feel a lot more calmer going into the things that I have anxiety built around. So, yeah, the being able to, like, the fact that I feel like I can write an email, just it means so much. It's insane how much that's changed my sense of self-confidence, really. Yeah. So I'll keep going with this for probably over a year, the whole course. And so every student starts clocks, but they have a sort of a cognitive assessment, which goes for, I think, for something hours. And then you, with that assessment, you sort of see the different areas that your strengths and your weaknesses are in. So I'm good at the visual stuff, but I'm really bad at the comprehension and concepts as well, time and reading and writing. So they're the kind of things that I'm going to focus on and, see what happens. So, yeah, it's an interesting journey.
That's amazing.
Mm, yeah, it's interesting.
So is the school specifically for adults with dyslexia, or is it just sort of they assess what your learning needs are in the beginning and so it's really for anybody?
I believe it's for anybody, but I know a lot of the students I practice with have, learning difficulties. So it could be dyslexia, it could be ADHD. It could be anything. And I think that the point of doing the assessment is to get a sense of how people's brains work so that they can sort of accommodate whatever they need, really. But I've practiced with students who are like under 10 years old, and then my mum's going to start as well, which is really cool. So, yeah, and she's, in her 60s. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting, I think, that having students from such a wide range is for them would just be really fascinating because they're adapting to different generations. So like for my mum, for instance, they've started a program that caters for, I guess they're called senior people, but it's to keep your brain active and sharp. So but for me, I'm trying to reconnect those neurological connections that are just not sparking, and I need them to spark. So yeah. And then some kids who are going through school, it's just sort of a bolster for their experience at school as well. So yeah, everyone goes in with their own intention.
Now, does your mother, did you get ADHD from her?
I don't know. It's interesting.
So has she now reevaluated her life and been like, oh, okay, this is going to make sense. Now.
I've put the question to her and we just don't know. It's so fascinating.
Yeah.
She thinks dyslexia has definitely come through her family. And because her dad dropped out of school early and so did her brother, and they've all like foster kid, they've all focused on one thing and they've been really successful at doing this one particular specific thing. So it would be interesting, but my brother and I are IVF kids, so I'm not sure if it doesn't come from my mum's side, it will come from my dad's, but I don't know the dad because the dad's side was the donor. So, yeah, have no idea. It's a bit of a mystery box. Yeah,
I know. I mean, my father's the obvious candidate.
Yeah.
But because he's much more of the, kind of scatterbrained, inattentive, pack rat kind of person. And so as soon as I connected the dots, I was like, oh yes. Okay. I clearly got it from him. My mother has passed away. And so I really wish I could have conversations with her about it. Not only because so much of my childhood, she was very confused as to why I did so poorly in school, and conversations like, she would say things to me like, well, not everybody goes to university. And I know she was trying to make me feel better at the time, it's not for everybody. Mm. That's what you would say as a mother to make your child feel better. But now looking back, I think it was comments like that really you know, my self-esteem really took a hit because my self-esteem was so tied to my inability to kind of show intellect. You know, and like you're saying with email writing, like it's, you're sort of like, it doesn't, it seems like a little thing, but when that ability to communicate becomes so deeply ingrained in how you view yourself, you know, in the world.
Absolutely.
And it's something you can't master when you're so, you're able to master other things. And I think that's what becomes so confusing to us is the fact that it's like, we can be very good at some things, but we put all of our focus in the things we are not good at, because those are the mysteries to us. Those are the puzzles to us. And then you have a teacher or teachers who say things like, well, why aren't you consistent? You need to be consistent. You need to get A's in every subject. And then that emphasis, you know, the sense of worth as you're growing up is on like your ability to be good at everything. So, you know, which is just impossible. Right. And so I think there are a lot of people who, you know, who don't think that way. I think they're sort of like, I'm good at X, Y, and Z, and therefore I don't have to be good at A, B, and C. But I think we're like, no, we have to be good at everything. If we're not, we will focus on the one thing we are terrible at, and that, you know, our self-worth will become wrapped up in that one thing we can't do.
It's fascinating. Through school, it was, oh, she's like, I'm not good at anything else but art. And that was just the narrative I built. And so I put so much effort into art, which I mean is been good because it's meant that I've arrived. I've had my own unique path, but really reassessing how you got to where you are now is such a journey, and trying to express yourself through it all as well. Very interesting.
Or you think about like elite athletes, right? Who have put all of their focus and energy into being an athlete, and then they get an injury and their career is over, and you're just like, have to like completely rebuild your life, right? Like it's almost at that point, you're sort of, I'm like, oh, I'm grateful I'm not really good at anything. Because now I don't have to go through whatever hardship it must be to, you know, lose that one passionate thing you're really great at.
This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. If you're a regular listener of this podcast, you know I am very open about my own experiences with therapy. I've been seeing the same therapist for years, and it was my therapist who first suggested I had ADHD and set me on this personal path of transformation. But it also took a while to find the right fit for me, which is why it is so awesome that online resources like BetterHelp exist. BetterHelp is not a crisis line. It is not self-help. It is professional counseling done securely online from the comfort of your home. And it's available for clients worldwide, so you get access to a broad range of expertise which might not be available locally. If you visit their website and read through their testimonials, there are actually quite a few reviews that specifically reference help with ADHD. As a special offer for listeners of the Women and ADHD podcast, you'll get 10% off of your first month. Simply sign up at betterhelp.com/womenADHD. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/womenADHD.
Yeah, right? It's so interesting the ways in which we gloss over immediately the things that we were talented in, and then only, you know, our narrative becomes such a focus on the few things that seem to elude us.
Yeah, but you know, culture sorts, like, I guess the world around you reinforces that so much. Like, for instance, I finished this artwork that was a large artwork for an art prize, and it took me about 4 months to do, and I put all my eggs in one basket with this work. And when I got it done, and I thought, okay, I've literally had no income for 4 months, and now it's time to get a job. And I thought, okay, well, I'll get something that can accommodate painting as well. So just a cafe job. And I've always done cafe work since I can remember. I'm a bad employee because I'd just be casual. But then I would have a pinch point with my art, and I would just say, I have to go. So I would leave, and worst employee ever. And then I'd come back. So like my resume had like maybe 3 months here, 2 months there. I never had a consistent job. And I was like 26 when I finished this work. And I remember trying to apply for basic cafe roles, like just jobs, casual jobs, dishes, all that sort of stuff. And one, I was too old, and so I was too expensive to employ as a casual dishy. I couldn't get a job anywhere. And I thought, oh, shit, I really have to make artwork. So I need to sell some paintings because I'm unemployable. I have no other skills on my resume. So, the world which I've created for myself in art, I really have to make that work for me. So, yeah.
Wow.
Huh. Yeah.
I want to take a minute to let you know about the new Women and ADHD online community. One thing I hear time and time again from listeners of this podcast is, wow, these interviews make me feel so much less alone. And I totally agree. I believe finding our people and sharing our lived experiences is such an integral part of successfully managing our ADHD. So I've put together this online community for listeners of the podcast where we can come together in a safe, intimate environment and make friends and obsessively ponder our neurodivergent brains with other brilliant, like-minded women. And we never have to apologize for simply being ourselves. With your membership, you also have access to all sorts of exclusive content, like early access to this podcast, written transcripts of the episodes, and a free copy of my audiobook, Worth It, A Journey to Food and Body Freedom. You also have the option to upgrade at any time in order to participate in regular body doubling sessions and live member hangouts on Zoom with me and other members where we discuss life with our ADHD brains. So head over to womeninadhd.com to join us or find the link in the show notes. All right, I hope to see you there soon.
So now if you could rename ADHD to something else that would be a little more relatable, yeah, especially to women, have you thought about something that you would call it?
Shame it's ADHD. I think all labels should just have cute animal faces on them, and every letter should be in the shape.
Oh my god, I love
every
it.
Every letter should be in the shape of some sort of animal. Tails and like. No, but no one can read it except for people with neurodivergence.
Oh my goodness.
Something like that.
I love it. Right? Big panda bears, an elephant. Oh, that would be fantastic. I think that's my favorite answer. I'm kind of getting bored of asking that question too, because I feel like we don't know. And then sometimes people ask me, like, what would you call it? I'm like, I don't know. I don't have an answer. That's why I ask other people.
Yeah.
but I don't know. I feel like I can't come up with a good reason. It's so complex. I feel like ADHD, just the more I learn about it, the more complicated it is and the harder it is to even sort of explain to people. And I think, you know, like I get more and more frustrated even talking about it with people who don't get it, you know?
Yeah,
like
I've stopped trying to
explain it to people, because it's so often when I first talked about this diagnosis, I was so happy. And yet there were so many people in my life who were like, oh, I'm so sorry.
I know,
to hear about
your
diagnosis.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah. I'm like, it's not a terminal illness.
Yeah, I'm not dying. Yeah. I was expecting a high five, but it's okay.
I know, right?
Don't leave me hanging. Yeah, totally.
And even, you know, and I talk about this with my husband too, with our kids, like, you know, my son, we're going to get him assessed this summer when school is over. And my husband's very worried about the stigma and, you know, going to think of himself as lazy if he has ADHD? And I was like, you don't get it. Like, he's going to think of himself as lazy no matter what.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
But if he can have a sense of where this is coming from and the why, like, he doesn't understand the importance behind the why of ADHD, right? That just having that explainer makes everything a little bit easier. It doesn't mean we're not going to have emotional regulation issues or rejection sensitivity dysphoria or like all of these things that plague us, but I think it just makes it a little bit easier.
So true. If my folks are like, oh, don't worry, she can't regulate her emotions. She can't express herself. It's just ADHD. I'll be like, oh, that would be so good. Thanks, Mum. Or
it would be. But, although I would probably also get annoyed and be like, don't tell me why I'm acting the way I'm acting. Don't tell me, it'd be like somebody being like, do you have your period? Do you have ADHD right now? Is that what's happening?
Too obvious. Yeah, totally.
No, I've got so much to thank for my parents, though. They're amazing. They're seriously amazing. Yeah, I'm sure the same with your folks as well. Just what they went through and what they didn't know, but they were trying so hard to understand and wrap their head around what was going on and how they just felt helpless. So I think the more knowledge, the better, really.
It has been comforting too when I've spoken to women who were diagnosed, 20 years ago as opposed to last year.
Yeah.
That there really was no idea about what it was 20 years
ago.
So even if you were diagnosed, people had no idea what that meant or what to do with it. There was still a sense that you would like outgrow it.
Yeah, exactly. you'll grow out of it. Or you'll just put in the weird club. That's it. And which is, cool as well.
Yeah, but it's still just, it feels like we're all just kind of walking around as living experiments, finding out about this interesting, crazy thing together. Like we're all on this one drug trip together. Like, whoa, that is so cool.
Yeah. No, it's fascinating with art because I feel like a imposter in my own field, if that makes sense. And I relate to people with neurodivergence of all backgrounds and kids, animals, all sorts of things. But I find that the art world is just so fickle, and quite often that's something that I'm learning to explore a bit more of, or just even explore the sense of what it feels like to be a bit of an outsider in that world, in that space. I'm not sure how to explain it, but that the feeling of being an imposter in your own field or in never feeling good enough. That sense of never being enough. It's a fascinating thing when things trigger you to feel like that. How do you handle with that feeling, that sense, when that sort of comes up in you?
Oh God. usually I'd say I'm never going to do this again. And I'm just like, I've made a terrible mistake and I'm going to crawl into a hole. I don't think that was the answer you were looking for, but
I'll remember that. Yeah.
But it's the same thing of, I mean, maybe there is some comfort in just knowing that this is part of the package,
Exactly.
I think, the one thing my podcast has never, I've never pretended to like have the answers for anyone. And I actually feel like in some way that's kind of the appeal of these conversations is that like a lot of the time we're just digging through the garbage, trying to make sense of it all.
Exactly.
And I think that is where the therapy is. Like, I think that's where we start to really kind of, I wouldn't even say like that's where the self-improvement is, but I just feel like that is kind of how we heal and that's how we learn about ourselves.
It's the knowing.
That's how we grow. I don't think being like, I'm going to figure out the 5 tips to being a successful entrepreneur. I think we get stuck in that trap that the answer is always around the corner and that somehow we're going to figure it out and everything's going to be happy forever. And, I think if we stop trying to buy into that fallacy that is achievable, and more so just feel like, okay, how can I just like, you know, understand why I feel this way?
Yeah, or
like,
exactly.
You know, like this is, I'm pouring my heart out and doing something that is really meaningful to me. And then if I ask people, if I have the gall to ask people to pay me for it, there's just crickets. You know, and then it's like, you know, but you realize that that's sort of a universal experience. If I throw that out there and you laugh with recognition, yeah. then I feel better about myself at least, because I'm like, okay, I'm not the only person who's experienced this. Right. So, all right. Well, I feel like I've kept you longer than I should have. But thank you so
much. Thank you. I hope I sound like I've just rambled the whole time. So thank you so much.
That's the beauty of these conversations.
God, I hope I made sense. But no, thank you so much.
There you have it. Thank you for listening. And I really hope you enjoyed this episode of the Women and ADHD podcast. Also, as you know, we ADHDers crave feedback, and I would really appreciate hearing from you, the listener. Please take a moment to leave me a review on Apple Podcasts or Audible or whatever other platform you're using. And if that feels like too much, and I get it, then just take a few seconds to give me a 5-star rating. Boom, done. Or share this episode on your own social media to help reach more women who maybe have yet to discover and lean into this neurodivergent superpower, and they may be struggling and they don't even know why. If you are a woman who was diagnosed with ADHD in adulthood and you'd like to be interviewed as a guest on this podcast, please reach out to me. My email is womenandadhdpodcast@gmail.com. I'll see you next week when I interview another amazing woman who has recently discovered that she is not lazy or crazy, but she has ADHD. And now she's on the path to understanding that neurodivergence and finally using it to her advantage. Take care till then.